Thank you all. Thanks. This is a story I'm going to read from my friend Pierre, who's in the audience, who is a scratch golfer, so I thought it might be fun. It's called Par. If you've already heard the story, anybody already heard it? Good. What John Dolworth liked about it at first was being outside in the dewy morning among shade trees and perfectly cut grass, the soft peaks and swells of the Blue Ridge Mountains in the distance. He liked the sounds, different bird calls, the tattoo of a woodpecker, the breezes in the leaves, the cleats on the cart paths, the metallic song of the clubs in the bag, the hum of the carts, even the brush swish and rattle of the ball washers. And the smells, too, earth and grasses and pine, leather and wood, and the pungent turf and fertilizer odor of the carpet-smooth greens. In the early mornings, the grass looked as though it was coated with diamonds, millions of dewdrops reflecting sun. Each fairway stretched out before him so invitingly the very essence of possibility. Of course, he had to admit that the possibilities were mostly bad for a beginner, the sand bunkers in their pristine, as yet undisturbed whiteness, and the tangled, often impenetrable woods, and the glass-smooth, slate-colored shapes of water bordering one hole or crossing the approach to another. He considered that these hazards were also beautiful, even when they cost him strokes, and he took so many strokes in the beginning. But the travails of each hole always led finally to the dropping of the ball into the cup, that hollow, solid little sound, like no other in the world. And when he leaned down to retrieve it at the end of its perilous journey, he would imagine the polite applause of the gallery. He told most of this to Regina Eklund on their first evening together, and Regina found that she liked the soft, kindly baritone timbre of his voice. It was a change. It was far from what she had been used to, and she began saying the things that she hoped would encourage him to ask for another date. He did so. Regina's friend Angie teased her about it. "Could this be love?" Angie said. "Well," said Regina, "just maybe it will be at that." "You can't be serious. He's bald, and he spends all his time in a golf cart." "You know, Angie, sometimes you can be pretty snobbish," Regina said, but she felt a twinge of doubt, which she tried to ignore. Her mother had expressed misgivings as well. It was too soon to be jumping into another relationship, especially with someone like that, a golf fanatic, a man who spent so much time on the links that his business was stagnating. Everybody had an opinion, even Dolworth's older brother, who managed the business and had already been divorced twice, and who, in his magisterial and austere way, had counseled patience, caution. To everyone who loved or cared for them separately, it seemed they were headed for disaster. And in spite of everything, this is a happy story. Part of the difficulty was the circumstances under which they met. When one took into account that she lived in a small house behind a row of small evergreens along the fourth fairway of Whiskey Creek Golf and Country Club, where John Dolworth had played dozens of times, the whole thing seemed absurd. Dolworth had sued a local car dealership for adding fraudulent charges to repair bills. The culprit in the case, the man who ran the part shop, was arrested for embezzlement and ended up being sentenced to jail for 5 years. This was Regina's dangerous live-in boyfriend, Bruce. The day Bruce was sentenced, she got in her car and made the trip to the other side of Point Royal to thank Dolworth for the favor. They had seen each other in court, Regina always with Bruce, clutching her purse with both hands and sitting with her perfect legs tight together. Dolworth was astonished to find her on his front porch. Bruce, she said, was not a nice man at all, and now that he would be in the hands of the authorities for a few important years, she planned to cut herself free of him. Dolworth had discerned that Bruce was one of those types who, when described by the women with whom they live, make others wonder what could have seemed attractive in the first place. She portrayed him as lazy, self-absorbed, bitter, bad-tempered, a felon, paranoid, and increasingly violent. And now, thank God, a prisoner. "And you're the one who got it done," she said. "I just wanted to tell you how grateful I am." "How did you find my address?" The clerk of the court is a friend of mine, Angie. You were always over there on the other side of the aisle, he told her. Well, I couldn't get up the courage to show my true feelings. Bruce might have killed me. Really? Dalworth was standing in his doorway with the door partly shut. Well, he's gone for the time being, she said. She turned slightly and looked off. The wind lifted a few shining strands of her reddish hair and let it fall again. He hit me sometimes. I'm sorry he did that to you, Dalworth said, wanting to close the door. He didn't know quite how he was expected to proceed now. She stood there, obviously waiting for him to do something. So, he said. She said, I spent 10 years like that, and smiled. I was just so grateful to you. He ended up taking her to dinner. They went to a small Italian restaurant in a mall a little south of the town of Winchester. It was a sunny early evening in July. Dalworth knew the restaurant and hoped she would admire, as he did, the European feel of the place once you got inside. The waiters were all Italian. The food was northern Italian, served with an easy, familiar dexterity and in marvelously decorative profusion. He watched her eat and finally decided simply to be honest with her. I feel so odd, he said. Do you feel odd? She pondered this, not in the least. They hadn't got far with dinner before he began to hope that they were going to be more than friends. The waiter brought the wine he had ordered. They drank it slowly while she talked about her plans, getting on with life, a new job in a bank away from the Walgreens where she had spent the last 5 years working. It would be good to have someone to go places with. Bruce had been such a couch potato. Dalworth asked her if she would like to go to a movie with him tomorrow evening. He felt the need to establish this while they seemed to be getting along so well. I'd love to, she said. You ever play golf, he asked. His enthusiasm was running away with him. I should, given where I live. There was a faintly sardonic note in her voice. Of course, when they built the country club, they took extra care to plant those little fat pines on the border of my yard. They don't like the fact that I'm there. My little rambler doesn't exactly fit the profile. I've been tempted to poison the trees, but I'd never do a thing like that, of course. Very gently, he said, would you like to learn how to play golf? I don't know. He would not push the golf if she showed no interest. He felt oddly precarious. He was almost 40. His one marriage had ended more than 12 years ago, a childless waste. He wanted a family, and this feeling had only grown stronger as the decade of his 30s ran out. He had feared that it was already too late. Regina's eyes looked so frankly straight at him, and he sensed that she enjoyed something in him over which he had no conscious control. He felt stupidly as if this one evening were some sort of last chance, and inwardly he berated himself for it, looking at the other people in the restaurant in their relaxed poses, their settled, pleasurable sociability. He had spent too much time alone in the last year. Now she spoke about seeing the golfers outside her bedroom window all day in the warm weather, and she speculated aloud about what they could be thinking as they shambled by together, but separate too. Sometimes it looked as if they were playing field hockey, hacking at the ball which just rolled along the ground a few yards at a time. It must be especially rewarding to be good at it. Yes, he said, but he was uncomfortably certain that he had been one of those people she had watched go by her window. He had to work to dismiss the thought. In 5 years, his lowest score was 66, but that had been for 9 holes. It's got a beauty, he told her, managing to sound authoritative. It's hard to explain to someone who doesn't know the game or play it. Sensing that she had made him uneasy, she sought other things to say. Nothing suggested itself. A disconcerting silence drew down on them. She gave him her best smile, worried that he would feel the quiet as displeasure. She had wasted the last decade with a man like Bruce, who was exciting and harrowing and interesting when he was sober and terrifying when he was drunk. She had stayed with him, she knew, out of a kind of recklessness that was also cowardly. She had a clear understanding of her own deepest troubles. And for some years now, she had grown ever more profoundly, even unreasonably frightened of growing old alone. That, too, was a reason for staying with Bruce. She was not pretty in the normal sense. Her face was too narrow, and her features gave her a look of a sort of continual renouncement, as though she had just declared against some abstract offense. She had tried to soften this by heightening her eyebrows and making her lips a little fuller with the lip gloss. Nothing worked. When she looked in a mirror, she saw the face of an irritable schoolteacher. She too wanted a family, and time was running out. But she could not say any of this to him. Dishonesty in love is not less common than in any other facet of life, and a person who swears the truth will be the centerpiece of his relations with others is a fool. She would be 36 in 2 months. Gazing into his almost feminine blue eyes, she realized that the sound of his voice calmed her. It actually pleased her. He had begun talking about his day out on the links. "Someday," she said, "I'll stay home from work and wait for you in my backyard. I'll have a drink all ready for you. All you have to do is walk up the fourth fairway and step through the row of trees, and there I'll be. How would you like that?" He smiled and hoped she'd forget the idea. The talk or the wine, he couldn't tell which, though he supposed it was the latter, had an apparently aphrodisiac effect upon her. He was describing the difficulty of hitting a ball on a downhill lie and getting any loft on it, talking now just to keep things going, feeling increasingly uneasy about the silences when she ran her stockinged foot up one side of his leg under the table. "Where do you work?" she asked. "I own this little company, you know, as they said in court." "I didn't hear a lot of what went on in court," she said, moving her foot. He couldn't breathe out for a second. And there's a small trust from my mother's estate. My mother owned a peanut company and sold it to a corporation. My company's a glass company." Her foot had reached above his knee and was starting back down. "Glass, yeah, you know, for windows. "So you don't have a profession?" "Well, I have the company. It took a lot to get it off the ground. There was an awful lot to do. It's stabilized, but it doesn't really make any money. It pays for itself. My older brother, Mac runs it. He's the type who manages things, and he's the older brother, you know." Her foot stopped moving. She sat upright, up straight. "I don't want you to think I'm fast," she said. "Everything's okay," he said to her. "Well," she said, "so what else?" He shrugged. "There's not much to tell. In the last 5 years, I've been involved in 11 civil cases, and this is the first time it resulted in a jail sentence for somebody." "Couldn't have happened to a better person." "Does Bruce hold grudges?" Dalworth asked her. She nodded thoughtlessly. "Tell me more about yourself." "5 years seems like a long time, but it goes by awful quick," he said. "Come on," she said, "tell me." His ex-wife had recently taken up domicile with a pair of gay men on Long Island somewhere. She was a photographer. Sex had troubled her. None of this seemed worth mentioning. The marriage had come apart without rancor or care, really. In other words, it had been a terrible catastrophe. He didn't even know where he had gone wrong. He told Regina how long it had been since the divorce. It was amicable, he said. She watched the small tremor of his hands, and his nervousness endeared him to her. She folded her own hands on the table and smiled. "It's been anything but amicable with Bruce." Regina had no understanding of sports, and the charms of golf had always eluded her. She had spoken about this often, too, and she mentioned it to her mother when Dalworth went off for a weekend in Canada to play a new course. The fact was he had played almost every day for most of his 30s, spending more money than he should, even traveling to southerly climes for an occasional weekend during the coldest months of the winter. He had probably been one of those people out on the grass behind her house, she told her mother, though she had never seen him play and, in fact, had no desire to. She liked him. She liked him. Her mother wanted to know if she hankered for him. She used the word. "I don't know," Regina said. "I felt that way about Bruce, and look what kind of life I had. This is friendly." He was beginning to be in love. When he returned from his trip, he called to tell her he had missed her and stumbled through a few clumsy remarks about the weather in Canada, how cool the mornings were and how long the dew stayed on the grass. He came to take her to lunch in the middle of her Monday, and he had already played another 18 holes, had teed off at 6:30 in a low ground fog, the misty dawn. She was fascinated, oddly enough. Having been married young and widowed young, a thing she didn't want to talk about, and having lived with a man like Bruce, who lacked the temperament or the ability to appreciate the subtleties of anything, She had been, she now realized, fairly starved for talk, any kind of discourse, something other than the books she escaped into, the silence of all that, or the empty racket of television. She craved simple human communication. She was on the rebound, as people say. To her, it felt like being able at last to breathe again. Because he was in love, he saw the circumstances of their meeting in an increasingly romantic light, as if they were characters in a film. When he talked to Mac, it was always about Regina. Mac, who watched a lot of television, found this tiresome. Dalworth would describe what she wore and report her conversational flourishes verbatim. Her forwardness was an aspect of her charm. She was bold. She seemed to be moving under a pressure. She had wide interests and a sophisticated way of discerning the heart of things. He liked to theorize about her. "There's a lot I don't know about her life," he said. "What about the business, John? What are you going to do?" "It's supporting itself, Mac. You don't let me do anything but sit there and answer the phone anyway." Mac's part of the inheritance from their mother was a small recording studio, or Mac had bought and outfitted the studio with his part of the money. This had turned out to be lucrative, and Mac was paying a young woman to run it for him. It was amazing how many people wanted to record themselves playing one instrument or another or singing their songs. "Bad songs," Mac said. He kept a little book with lines from the really bad ones. In his opinion, John's obsession with golf was a little like these would-be songwriters, all of them so anxious to protect the copyrights as though anyone in the world would want to steal such awful stuff. Recently, he had taken to saying lines from the songs when his younger brother started talking about Regina. "She's mysterious, Mac, truly mysterious. There's things she won't talk about. How can I say I'm sorry when my foot is in my mouth?" "What?" "I love your smell. Mac, do you want me to stop calling you? I don't want to talk about Regina, bro, okay?" With Regina, Dalworth talked about his travels to distant places to play golf. They became regulars at a Mexican restaurant at the entrance to the Skyline Drive. The restaurant was owned and run by a Bulgarian gentleman, and they sat in the window sipping red wine. She wanted him to talk. She would ask about his day and then insist that he recount what he could remember of his round. She was learning about the game in this fashion, and for her it was so much better than watching it. So he would go through the day's shots, being exact and honest. 8 strokes on the par 4 first hole, 13 on the par 5 second, 9 on the par 4 third, 7 on the par 3 fourth. She had a way of lazily blinking as he talked, which at first made him nervous. "You can't want me to go on." She said, "I do too." "You're not bored?" "I'm not bored. I'm calm. It calms me to listen to you. I like to picture everything." So he tried to be more clear about the lay of the land, the look of things. He had discovered in himself a capacity for description. Whereas once he had talked to release attention, he was now indulging himself, and he began exaggerating a little. He scrupulously kept his own score, but when he spoke to Regina about his days, the shots began to straighten out. The pars came more often with slowly increasing regularity, and birdies began to happen too. One afternoon, he scored an eagle on the long par 5 15th at Skeeterville Trace in Charlottesville. It was actually a 12, but it would have taken too long to tell her each shot, the 3 that he hit in the water, and the 2 that were lost in the brush at the dog leg, the 4 mulligans he'd taken, the first he had ever allowed himself, to keep the number at 12. He described for her the long looping drive off the tee, "No feeling like it in the world," he said, and the chance he took on the approach using a 3-wood uphill, the ball rolling to the fringe of the green, and then the 45-foot putt through tree shadows downhill. It was all vivid in his mind as if it had actually unfolded that way, and she sat there gazing at him, sweetly accepting. Perhaps he had begun to believe it himself. Regina, of course, was unimpressed, not because she felt any superiority, but because she wasn't really listening to the words. She basked in the sound of his voice, and she could listen to him without really attending to the details. He was so gentle. He was careful of her, and she liked the way his chin came to a little cleft, liked the blue sparkle in his eyes, which gave her an idea of the little boy he must have been. She thought about him when she was alone, felt glad looking forward to him, waiting for him to arrive after his day. He seldom talked about the business, except to mention casually that Mac was having new phones installed and they were about to be audited again. Mac handled everything. Mac had been the one all their lives who was good at things, captain of the football team, co-captain of the basketball team, the star third baseman. Mac had been born sleek, fast, quick of foot, agile, and he had possessed a cruel streak, a killer instinct. John told her about him without mentioning what must have been apparent by contrast, that he himself had been too thin, too gangly and slow, almost dopey. He made self-deprecating jokes about his dreadful youth, but these things were dropped in conversation as if they didn't matter very much, offhand, as talk about the weather. Dalworth was happy, and perhaps she had never known a really happy man before. He spent a lot of time imagining them together, married, but it was painfully difficult to find the courage. He would plan exactly how he might ask her, would head for her house with resolve beating in his breast, and then when they were together each time, he'd lose his nerve. He would end up lying about what he had done on the golf course again. This was beginning to bore him. It was also getting out of hand. They talked about other things, of course, and she had a way of observing people that made him a little apprehensive about what she must be able to discern in him. But they were more often glad than they were uncomfortable, and she would eventually lead him back to talking about the game, his day's game. And she sat there staring, blinking slowly with such wonderful attention. He would have gone on forever to keep that soft look on her face. The rainy afternoon of her birthday, they slept together for the first time. It was actually as awkward as she had feared it might be. But it was considerate, too, and rather more tender than had ever been her experience. They lay quiet for a time and then began again, and she found, to her surprise, that she could forget herself. Later, while he held her, she told him of her early marriage, how her husband, a man she had loved and who had come with her out of her adolescence, had been killed in Australia in a freakish accident, an accident which nevertheless made a certain kind of terrible sense. His name, she said, she still believed it was purest coincidence, was also Bruce. This Bruce, her first love, had traveled to Sydney as a panel member for a conference sponsored by an insurance group concerning the different rates of occurrence of auto accidents under various traffic conditions and controls. Not 15 minutes after he arrived at his hotel, he had gone out for a walk and, stopping at a curbside, had looked left, where right lane traffic would be in the United States, and then stepped out in front of a bus, which was, of course, oncoming in the left lane since this was Australia, where everything was backward. Well, she said, not backward, you know what I mean. It had been a long time since she had spoken of this, and it was her 36th birthday. Her own sadness surprised her. She felt tears come. Dalworth hurried to say how sorry he was. Perhaps this was the opening, the chance he could take to ask for her hand. He mustered all his nerve, took a breath, staring into her brimming eyes, opened his mouth, stopped, breathed again, and heard himself say, "I had another eagle this morning." Somewhere in the synapses of his brain, there was what he'd meant to go on and say, that he wouldn't consider an eagle or a hole-in-one, for that matter, to be much of an accomplishment if he couldn't have her for a wife. The absurdity of it made him stop at the word morning, and anyhow, she hadn't heard him. She was still thinking about her first love. She said, "You know the last thing Bruce said to me? He lived for a couple of weeks. I got to see him. The last thing he said was, 'Reggie, do you believe how ridiculous this is? He always called me Reggie.'" Dalworth was at a loss. It occurred to him that if they remained here in this small brick house with its patter of rain on the roof, she would just grow more sad. He could not ask her to marry him while she wept over being 36 and a widow, while she continued to think of her first love. The rain ran down the window. His inheritance check wasn't due for another week. Mac wasn't letting him have any income from the glassware business. It might have been so wonderful to say, "Let's go down to Florida and play a few holes at Sawgrass." He supposed he could arrange it. But now, in the moment, the idea seemed too extreme and even in some obscure way aggressive. He said, "Let's go out and play the fourth hole." "It's raining, so there's no lightning or anything." "I never even held a golf club." She seemed amused by the idea. "I'll show you. You're kidding me." "I've never been more serious in my life." She stared at him. "I got my clubs in the trunk of the car." She got up and walked naked to the window and looked out. The rain streamed on the glass and made a reflection of itself trailing down her skin. She looked lovely, he thought, though somehow wounded, flawed, too vulnerable. He averted his eyes, with some effort of seeming casually to glance at the clock on the wall. "Well," he said. She gazed at the intricately folded grayness hanging over the wet trees, the dragging ends of clouds sailing away in the breezes. She said, "All right." The warm rain soaked them before they got very far down the fairway to the tee. The leaves of the maples and oaks flanking the lawns of the newer houses drooped. They looked black. A thick mist obscured the descending slope off the tee, and to the left, the sixth green seemed half absorbed into the whiteness of mist and ground fog. They heard traffic in the near distance and the far-off hum of a groundskeeper's tractor. But nothing moved nearby. He carried his clubs on his shoulder, and she held onto his other arm, keeping close. He felt rather amazingly good. Her dress, a blue cotton one with short sleeves, hung on her, as did her hair, which was two shades darker. She looked like a little girl. He set his bag against the wooden bench, got two Max Flies out, pocketed them, selected the driver, gripped it, waggled it slightly. She stood a few paces away, arms folded, watching. Back in high school, when Mac had been best at all the sports, Dalworth used to watch his older brother strut and achieve for his beautiful girlfriend, who was not a cheerleader but could have been, and who was always right there watching him. Dalworth had never been granted the experience. He propped the club against his leg and brought out his glove and a couple of tees. "You need a glove? Especially today," he said, peering off into the rain and mist, aware of her gaze on him. As he stepped up to the hitting area, it occurred to him that in all the thousands of attempts he had made to hit the ball right, he had succeeded so little and so few times. Abruptly, and with something like the feeling of terrible discovery, he had a moment of knowing how slim his chances were of striking the ball right under any circumstances, much less these. He hesitated, remembering, as a little spasm worked in the nerves at the base of his neck, all the lies he had told her in the last few weeks. He had, for some reason, not felt them as lies. The rain poured over his head and shoulders, and he looked at the water-soaked ground and was afraid. He took a practice swing. He felt rusty, though he had played 36 holes yesterday. Perhaps he should let her try to hit it first. Steeling himself for what he was now almost certain would be a humiliation, he gripped the ball with the tee and set it down into the soft earth. "I'm excited," she said. The rain had drenched her. Mascara streaked her face. She looked like a crying clown. "Here goes," he said. She nodded. Water poured past her chin. He stepped up to the ball, planted his feet, and stepped back to take another practice swing. The club felt wrong. The grip was wet now. Everything ran with the rain, water beating up on the clean aluminum shaft. He stepped back to the ball, held his head still, eyed the ball, its whiteness in that rainy light, thinking to keep the left arm straight. He pulled back slowly, trying to remember everything. And he felt, as he reached the top of his backswing, that he was going to smash it. He was going to knock it, disappearing into the mist, the longest and best hit of his life, because this was romance and how it ought to be, and God would give it to him. He felt it in his bones. It was meant to be, something they would talk about many years from now, the perfect smack of the ball, its flight into the obscure distance. He brought the club down with huge force and caught the wet ground about a foot behind the ball. The club head dug into the mud, and the shock of it went up his arms. It took some effort to pull it out, and as he did so, it made an embarrassing sucking sound. But he kept his balance and tried to seem casual, waggling the club head with its clod of dirt clinging to it. The dirt looked like a wet rag. He tapped the club head against the ground twice, and the clod dropped off. There was now a deep gash in the turf behind the ball. Bending down, water pouring from him, he moved the ball a few inches further along. She was a dark blue shape in the corner of his eye, standing very still. For her part, she had understood that things were going wrong and had attributed this to the weather. His swing looked nothing like the few she had seen on television. There was something too deeply swaying about it, as if he were trying something balletic. She wanted to encourage him, but kept silent for fear of distracting him, knowing that people kept still while a golfer was getting set to hit the ball. She was a little surprised when he turned to her. "You okay?" he said. This touched her, that he could be worried about her at such a time, contending with the rain, someone so serious about what he was trying to do. Sure, she smiled. He thought she was trying not to laugh. Sorry this is taking so long, he said. I'm not usually this slow. I'm fine. He addressed the ball, attempted once more to keep all the instructions in his head, left arm stiff, weight evenly balanced, head still, concentrating. He brought the club back, told himself to swing easy and shifted too much, nearly lost balance, bringing the club around with far more speed than he intended and missed everything. The bright, wet aluminum shaft made a water-throwing swish. He stepped back, another practice swing. You really look violent, she said. It's a violent thing, he told her, the swing. I can see that. This had been the wrong thing to do. He tried forgetting that she was there and swung and hit wide of the ball, this time taking another very large muddy divot that traveled a good 40 yards. She watched it arc out of sight into the mist and understood that this too was not a good thing. She could hear the distress in his breathing. Wow, she said, because she can think of nothing else to say. He waggled the club, put it up to the ball, and accidentally bumped it off the tee. It rolled an inch. Damn rain, he said, bending to set it right again. It's really coming down, she said. He swung, missed once more, hitting behind it again, another cloud of mud. Now he stepped closer and with no waggle at all, swung again. He made contact this time. The very tip of the club head sent the ball on a direct line at a 90-degree angle from him, hit the tee marker slightly to the right of its curve, ricocheted, and seemed to leap in a white trailing streak toward the ball washer standing 10 feet away and behind the tee. The ball bounced off that, came back like a shot, and struck him in the groin. He went down on all fours, then lay down, and she was at his side, hands on his arm, trying to turn him. For a very few awful moments, he was aware only of his pain and of the spreading area of pain in his middle. He held his hands around his upper abdomen out of sheer humiliation. She was saying something, but he couldn't hear it. He was sick to his stomach. The rain pelted his face, and then it was water pouring from her hair. She had put her face down to his. Are you all right? She said. Okay, he managed. He did not look okay to her. She knew the ball had struck him, but hadn't seen exactly where. Because he was holding his stomach, she assumed it was there. It had all happened so fast. Can you get up? She said. No, he said, my ball. He stopped and tried to hide what he had almost said in a gasp of air. I don't know where it went. No, he said, please. It hit you, she said. I didn't see. My balls, he said. It had come out in spite of him. He wanted to sink down into the wet grass and mud and disappear. From where he lay, he could see the divots and dug up places where he had tried to be someone other than who he was. Can you get up? She said. He found that he could. He had imagined that they would play the fourth hole and he would help her. The whole thing seemed like an idiotic kid's dream now, all of it, including ever getting any good at this game. She was helping him walk. My clubs, he said. Damn, everything's getting wet. Here, she told him, moving him slightly. She got him to sit on the bench. He saw his golf club lying where he had dropped it and the ball, a few feet away in a perfect lie, the surrounding drenched greenness. She had placed herself on the bench next to him and held his hands in her own. Doesn't make any difference, she said, really. It was clear to her now where he had been hit. She put her arms around him. They might have been huddled there against some great grief. The rain kept coming. He couldn't speak quite yet. Someday when it's dry, she told him. At the house, she helped him out of his clothes and got him to lie down in the bed with a blanket up to his shoulder. He lay on his side. His hair soaked the pillowcase and he began to shiver. The nausea had subsided somewhat. He remembered his clubs and tried to tell her about them, but she had anticipated him. I'll be right back, she said. When she had been gone a few seconds, he got himself out of the bed and limped to the window to look out at her beyond the little row of fir trees making her way along the wet fairway in the rain, hurrying, her arms folded tight about herself. He had never felt so naked. She disappeared into the misty, raining distance while he watched. Then, moaning low, feeling sick again, he went into the bathroom and looked at himself, all goose flesh. He pulled a towel off the rack and began drying his hair. There wasn't anything to put on, nothing to do to get out, get away. In her closet, he found a man's clothes, the second Bruce's clothes. They were all way too big for him. The sleeves hung down, the shoulders sagged. He put them back and went along her hallway to the dryer, his clothes tumbling there. He opened the door and looked in. They were all still very wet. Closing the door with a barely suppressed moan, he pressed the button to start it again. It would be an hour at least. He struggled. It was still very hard to walk. Back to the window. She was nowhere. Here was her small patio with its wrought iron furniture, a round table, four chairs, a closed umbrella. He saw citronella candles, an overturned glass, a small statuette of a bird in flight. The gas grill had a black cover over it like a cowl. Water ran down the sides. It all looked alien, so much not his, not home. He got himself back under the blankets and waited. His eyes burned. He discovered that he was deeply drowsy and wondered if he might pass out. She had started down the fairway, uncomfortable and even irritable in the rain, wondering what would happen now. She felt oddly that some serious change would come, and she recalled how her grief over the first Bruce had included an element of anger at him for getting killed in that bungling way. She had always felt guilty for that unacceptable emotion, and perhaps she had put up with the second Bruce's casual mistreatment of her as a kind of atonement. Nearing the fourth tee, she had an image of Dolworth flailing at the ball. And its little yellow tea made her begin to laugh. She couldn't help herself. She went to the bench and sat down, sopping wet, her dress flapping on her thighs with every movement, and she put her hands to her face and laughed helplessly, almost hysterically, for what seemed a long while. It would be hard to explain what took so much time, but she felt confident of his kindness, his wish to please her, and anyway, she couldn't move. The muscles of her rib cage seized up, and she went on laughing. Finally, she picked up the club, the ball, and dropped each one by one into the bag. Then she began trying to haul it back to her house. For a slow, pouring, almost painful 15 minutes, she was just moving in the heavy mist and rain, surrounded by the soft, sodden, close-clipped grass. The base of the bag created a dark mud street like a plow blade behind her. She didn't care. Her back ached. Her arms felt as though they might pull out of the sockets. She found him curled up in her bed. She set the bag of clubs under the eave of the patio and stepped inside, dripping. "I'm going to take a shower," she said. "Want to join me?" He was asleep. She stepped to the edge of the bed, gazed at him, then reached down and shook his shoulder a little more roughly than she meant to. "Hey!" He rose up out of a dream of being jostled in a crowded place and was startled to find her looming over him, water beaded on her face, running down her jaw, her hair matted to her cheeks. He noticed that her ears stood straight out from her head, and oddly this made him ache under the heart. He almost reached up and touched her cheek. "I'm sorry," he said. "It was all a lot of lying." "What?" "I'm not any good at it," he told her. "I'm awful, and I'm not getting any better." "You're okay," she told him. She went in and took a brief shower, toweled off, and put a bathrobe on. She found him still in the bed. "Those other clothes are all too big for me," he said, and began to cry. This startled them both. She got into the bed with him and held him like a little boy. When he had gained control over himself, he said, "I don't know." She resisted the urge to be sharp with him. She said, "John, are you physically damaged?" He turned to look over his blanketed shoulder at her. "What do you mean? Do you need a doctor?" "I don't think so, no." "Do you know what aspect of golf I've never understood and would like to understand?" He waited. "Putting." "I'm even worse at that," he told her with a disconsolate sigh. "I've heard people say it's the hardest thing." "I thought Bruce never played." "Let's not talk about him or anybody named Bruce," she said. A moment later, he said, "It is hard to do putting, and I bet you could show me a lot," she said. He understood perfectly well what she was doing now, and he knew that he would never question it or examine it very closely. She lay breathing into the base of his neck here under the blanket, her arm resting on his abdomen, the elbow causing the slightest discomfort, but she was this friendly presence trying to give him something. He said, "Can I stay here tonight?" "You know you can." He shifted a little, and she moved her arm so that her hand rested on his hip. "If it stops raining, maybe in the morning we can spend some time on the practice green," he said. She murmured, "That would be fun." They went to sleep almost at the same time and dreamed separately, of course. She saw herself leading children through a sunny field of flowers, and too many of them were misbehaving, breaking the stems off. He dreamed that he was dreaming in her bed while she emptied the closet of clothes that were, as things often are in dreams, outlandish, out of all scale, and too big for any normal man. Thank you so much for listening.